What's happening out there, guys? Welcome to the very first episode of our brand new series, the Top 100 Movies from the 1990s. That's right, we're counting down the ultimate flicks from the decade that gave us grunge, dial-up internet, and enough movie moments to fill video stores across the country for years. In this episode, we're diving into the first batch, movies ranked 100 through 91. We've got cult classics, forgotten favorites, and a few surprise entries. Whether you're here for the nostalgia or just looking to fill out your 90s watch list, you are in the right place. So grab your popcorn, hit that subscribe button, and let's kick off this next level countdown. First up, I have the teen comedy that made baked goods legendary. American Pie follows four high school guys on a mission to lose their virginity, starring Jason Biggs, Allison Hannigan, and Eugene Levy in a coming-of-age classic that's crude, chaotic, and weirdly heartfelt. Welcome to the film that launched 1,000 awkward teen comedies and made baked goods feel violated. This was one of the first DVDs I ever owned, and when I had my apartment and I couldn't afford cable, this one just played on repeat. It follows Jason Biggs and his friends on a desperate, clumsy, and just completely hormone-fueled quest to lose their virginity before graduation. It's raunchy, it's loud, it's oddly sincere. Yes, there's the infamous pie scene. Yes, there's Stifler, the human embodiment of Miller High Life and Bad Decisions, but there's also a surprisingly sweet core beneath all the gross-out gags, especially with the moments with Allison Hannigan's this one time at band camp Michelle. I think Eugene Levy steals every scene as Jim's painfully supportive dad, just delivering sex ed lectures that should be banned, and yet they are kind of wholesome. And sure, some of the jokes now land with more unintentional humor, but American Pie still captures that weird mix of teenage panic and friendship and the idea that growing up is equal parts confusing and sexy. I mean, American Pie walked so every modern teen comedy could run and possibly trip over its shoelaces. This movie is crude and chaotic, somehow charming, and just perfect with a slice of apple pie. Here, Wes Craven turns a home invasion flick into a twisted, satirical nightmare. The People Under the Stairs follows a kid who breaks into a creepy house in the neighborhood and quickly finds out that the real horror isn't just what's inside, it's what's under the stairs. Wes Craven would take a break from slashers and dive headfirst into horror here with a splash of social satire. This isn't just a haunted house movie, it's a full-blown descent into suburban nightmares, complete with cannibals, creepy homeowners, and kids living in the walls. Our hero here is Fool, a street smart kid who breaks into a spooky mansion with some local thieves, and what starts as a burglary quickly turns into a rescue mission when he discovers this twisted couple, displayed with terrifying glee by Everett McGill and Wendy Robbie, are just hiding their many dark secrets behind their locked doors. There are traps, secret tunnels, shotgun chases, and one truly unsettling gimp suit. I remember watching this at the second run theater by my house, and then just countless times on cable. This was like one of those teen adventure movies wrapped in a horror flick, and we all just loved it. We all had that house in our neighborhood that kind of felt like it could be the one from this movie. I think here Craven mixes horror and humor like a mad scientist, creating something both creepy and strangely enjoyable. It's bonkers in all the best ways and unlike anything else in the genre. Now, if eight legs give you the creeps, then brace yourself. Arachnophobia is here to tap dance on your spine. Directed by Frank Marshall, this horror comedy sees Jeff Daniels and John Goodman taking on a small-town spider invasion with laughs and shrieks and a flamethrower or two. This horror comedy hybrid drops a South American spider into small-town America, and suddenly, every corner of your house feels like a threat. Here, Jeff Daniels plays a doctor who's deeply afraid of spiders, which is a great start, and then John Goodman shows up as the gloriously over-the-top exterminator who really steals the movie with every bug-crushing line that he delivers, and together they battle eight-legged assassins while trying not to freak out, which is something they routinely fail at as this invasion escalates. The film really does walk a tightrope between being funny and terrifying, and somehow it pulls it off flawlessly. I mean, one minute you're laughing at Goodman's bug-squashing swagger, then the next you're checking your shoes for surprises before you put them on to go to the bathroom. I remember watching this movie in the theater, and people were just freaking out and having a complete blast with it. The tone here is part Spielbergian adventure and part Saturday Night Creep Fest, and I think what makes Arachnophobia just work is its restraint, until it doesn't. The spiders are real, no CGI here for the most part, and I think that realism just makes the scares land much harder. It's not about giant monsters, it's about one spider crawling into your popcorn bucket. Call it a thrillomedy, call it a spider core, just don't watch it in the dark with a ball of popcorn. Wayne's World would bring Mike Myers and Dana Carvey's beloved SNL duo to the big screen for the masses, where their public access show would soon collide with fame, capitalism, and Alice Cooper. It's a head-banging, slang-slinging ode to friendship and 90s rock culture just filled with nostalgic cameos. It would all start in a basement and somehow become a cultural phenomenon. Wayne's World, based on the SNL sketch, is a rock and roll comedy where public access TV meets corporate greed and two slackers with great hair who just want to stay true to themselves and their playlists. Myers and Carvey are Wayne and Garth, lovable dorks who speak fluent pop culture and just want a party when their little show gets picked up by a sleazy executive played perfectly by Rob Lowe. They're thrust into the big leagues and quickly learn fame does come with strings, but what makes Wayne's World work isn't just the catchphrases. To me, it's the weird sincerity beneath the silliness. These guys genuinely love the music, they love each other, and their bizarre little world. I think Penelope Spheeris' direction just nails the tone perfectly. It breaks the fourth wall, it features dream sequences with Tia Carrere, and includes a Bohemian Rhapsody headbanging scene that just basically brought Queen back from the dead. This was another movie I remember seeing in the theater and then on cable just countless times. We quoted it frequently throughout high school. It's goofy, it's remarkably quotable, and just surprisingly sweet. And Wayne's World didn't just spoof the 90s, it kind of helped define them. Adam Sandler turns golf into a contact sport in Happy Gilmore, where hockey brawls meet country clubs and Shooter McGavin gets what's coming to him. It's directed by Dennis Duggan, and it's the sports comedy where Sandler gets his ass kicked by Bob Barker, and somehow that's not even the wildest part of this movie. Now, if golf ever needed a hero, it certainly wouldn't be Happy Gilmore, but we're glad he showed up anyways. Adam Sandler stars as a failed hockey player who discovers he can drive golf balls like Thor throws hammers. The result? A sports comedy that's aggressively dumb and undeniably hilarious. Happy Gilmore just turns country clubs into war zones. I watched this movie so many times growing up. I would always try my Gilmore drive at the range. I actually remember cracking my friend's dad's Callaway driver and having to pay him back $150, which at the time might as well have been $1,500. Regardless, though, in this movie, Happy's temper is legendary, his swing is chaos incarnate, and his idea of golf etiquette includes throwing hands with Bob Barker and somehow losing. It's just a beautiful comedy. Christopher McDonald steals every scene as Shooter McGavin, the smug villain that we love to hate, who eats pieces of crap for breakfast. There's also Carl Weathers as Happy's one-handed coach, a grandma who just wants her house back. This movie is absurd from start to finish, but it's got heart, and Sandler's underdog charm carries it through every putt, punch, and profanity-laced tirade. Happy Gilmore to me is just really the perfect blend of childish humor and adult rage. It may not improve your golf game, but it will absolutely improve your day. Here, James Cameron makes a love story so big only an iceberg can sink it. In Titanic, Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet steam up the screen and capture the world's hearts as Jack and Rose, star-crossed lovers aboard the most famous shipwreck in history, and a double VHS movie that nearly every home in the country had stuffed into their cluttered entertainment centers. Here, James Cameron built a boat, crashed it into an iceberg, and created one of the most iconic romances in cinematic history. Now, I'll be honest, I was never a huge fan of this movie as a teen. I've grown to appreciate it a little bit more as I've gotten older. I do remember the second tape of the VHS copy was the better one because it's pretty much all sinking ship from there, with all the mushy stuff being swapped out with delightful chaos and just heartache and suspense. The Titanic is part historical epic, it's part teen heartache and part disaster movie, and it had enough box office power to make every other studio jealous for a decade. Leonardo DiCaprio is Jack, the scrappy artist who wins a ticket aboard the doomed ship. Kate Winslet is Rose, the wealthy fiance with too much jewelry and not enough freedom. Together, they draw naked, they dance in the steerage and fall in love right before everything turns into a giant cold swimming pool. I think the effects still hold up great. I mean, that ship breaking in half, it's brutal. The final plunge into the sea, it's chilling. Here, Cameron's eye for detail is obsessive, I think, and it really shows with just every steam pipe and life jacket. And sure, this movie gave us I'm the King of the World, and that door debate still divides the internet, but the Titanic also gave us a sweeping, tragic love story that managed to be both deeply personal and larger than life. It's the kind of film that dares you to roll your eyes, then will make you cry anyways, but we all must remember the most important aspect of this movie. Jack could have fit on that door. You know it, and I know it. The Pixar toy box opened in 1995, and animated cinema would be changed forever. Toy Story, directed by John Lasseter, introduced us to Tom Hanks's Woody, Tim Allen's Buzz, and a Pixar-powered world where your childhood toys have feelings and the emotional range to prove it. Before Toy Story, the biggest drama in animation was who got to be king of the jungle. Then came Pixar and gave us talking toys with emotional baggage, and the game would be changed forever. This one introduced us to Woody, a pull-string cowboy whose world is turned upside down when shiny new Buzz Lightyear arrives on the scene. Suddenly, Woody's no longer top toy in Andy's room, and of course, he doesn't handle it well. And what follows is part buddy comedy, part existential crisis, part high-stakes toy rescue mission, and just all adventure. Woody and Buzz go from rivals to reluctant allies to best friends, and somewhere along the way, you realize you're just way too emotionally invested in a plastic space ranger's friendship with a stuffed cowboy. Now, visually, Toy Story was revolutionary. It was the first full-length feature film made entirely of CGI, but to me, it's the writing, the humor, and the heart that made it a classic. From Mr. Potato Head's sass to Rex's anxious roars, every toy gets a moment. Every adult watching finds themselves unknowingly connecting back to their inner child. I've never been a huge fan of animated movies, but this one was the total package. It's not just a kid's movie, it's a story about growing up and being replaced and finding your place in a changing world, all wrapped up in a vibrantly nostalgic adventure. Jim Carrey trades slapstick for soul in The Truman Show, where director Peter Weir turns paranoia into art. Truman thinks his life is too perfect because it is. He's the unwitting star of a 24/7 reality show, and it's time for him to finally break free. Imagine waking up one day and realizing your whole life is a reality show. Cameras in the bathroom, fake best friends, even your wife's product placement monologues. That is The Truman Show, a deeply clever and just oddly touching dramedy starring Jim Carrey in what I'd consider to be a career-defining role for him. He plays Truman Burbank, a charming insurance salesman who starts suspecting that things are a little off. The sky doesn't quite look right. The same people walk by at the same time every day, and his wife keeps pitching kitchen goods like she's auditioning for QVC, and what follows is a slow-burning unraveling as Truman just peels back the set of walls to his perfect life, and I think it's as charming as it is intriguing to see unfold. I think Laura Linney is great here as the Stepford wife turned hostage. Ed Harris is great as well as Kristoff, the show's godlike creator. But to me, the brilliance of The Truman Show is how it mixes comedy and existential dread like peanut butter and jelly. It's funny, sure, but it also taps into that universal fear of what if none of this is real? This movie came out before the reality TV era exploded, so it kind of feels eerily prophetic now. I think this movie just quietly runs the full spectrum. I mean, acting, writing, direction, cinematography, scoring, all just perfect for the tone. And in the end, Truman's journey from passive viewer to free-thinking rebel is just surprisingly rewarding. And when he touches the edge of his world and chooses to walk out, that's not just a great moment. It's a mic drop for the human spirit and easily one of Carrie's most iconic scenes. In Menace to Society, the Hughes brothers deliver a gritty, no-punches-pulled look at life in South Central L.A. following Kane and O-Dog, played with a fierce intensity by Tyron Turner and Lorenz Tate as they try to escape the cycle of violence before it swallows them whole. Now, Menace to Society is not here to sugarcoat anything. Directed by the Hughes brothers and truly just a fearless debut, this movie opens with a liquor store scene that's as shocking as it is unforgettable, and from there it only gets more intense. Set in the neighborhoods of Watts and Crenshaw, the film follows Kane, played with what I think is a quiet complexity by Tyron Turner. He's a teenager wrestling with survival, loyalty, and whether he's got a way out or if he's already in just too deeply entrenched in a predetermined future. Then there's Lorenz Tate as O-Dog, who gives one of the most chillingly charismatic performances in 90s cinema. He's funny, shows glimpses of charm. He's also terrifying and unpredictable, all within the same breath. He's a true cinematic wild card in this movie. The whole thing just feels dangerously real, like a documentary that forgets to turn the camera off. I think the Hughes brothers shoot this movie with just an emotionally raw power that will pull you in. There's no glamour in the violence. It's bloody. It's chaotic. It really does hurt. I remember seeing this movie in the theater and just being glued to the screen. It builds a foreboding uneasiness and leaves you with more questions than answers. And that's kind of the point. Menace to Society isn't just a hood film. It's an unrelenting kind of boots on the ground snapshot of just systemic failure, youth under pressure, and choices made with no good options. The movie that just grabs you by the collar and demands that you look, and it's certainly a lot to take in, but it's also essential viewing. So what do you get when John Travolta and Nicolas Cage literally swap faces? In John Woo's action fever dream Face-Off, it's identity theft with doves and explosions and peak 90s insanity, directed with slow motion flair and starring two actors in full go big or go home mode. Now, when you hear John Travolta and Nicolas Cage are swapping faces, you might assume it's a Saturday Night Live sketch gone too far, but it isn't. It's Face-Off, a real movie directed by action maestro John Woo, and it's every bit as wild as it sounds. Travolta plays FBI agent Sean Archer, Cage is terrorist Castor Troy, and thanks to sci-fi surgery and zero HIPAA oversight, they become one another in a bullet-soaked identity crisis with rocket launchers, racing boats, and doves. This movie was the era before superheroes hogged every summer. My friends and I all went to see this movie like three or four times, and we just ate it up like free pudding. I mean, Cage was closing out his 90s action run. Travolta was on a resurgent. It had big time stars. It had big time action. And yet it's not just about the action. It's performance art with explosions. I mean, Cage kicks the film off with a hallelujah enriched gusto while Travolta tries to keep it serious. But I mean, once the face swap happens, it's game on. Travolta goes full Cage. Cage channels unhinged grief like he's trying to win an Oscar and a WWE belt. It's one of the most entertaining cases of actor role reversal in cinematic history, and John Woo directs this one like a ballet with bullets. It's got slow motion standoffs, mirrored shootouts, and a satisfying boat chase to bring it all home. It's ridiculous, it's operatic, endlessly quotable, and somehow it works. And to me, Face Off is peak 90s excess in all the best ways. And there you have it, guys. 10 unforgettable films from the 90s that spanned face-swapping lunacy, talking toys, deadly spiders, and enough teen awkwardness to fill a high school cafeteria, whether you were crying on the Titanic or laughing at Happy's golf rage or just nervously checking your popcorn after arachnophobia. These movies defined a generation and proved one thing. The 90s were wild, and we loved absolutely every second of it. So if you have enjoyed this trip down memory lane, hit that like button, subscribe for more cinematic content, and just let me know down in the comments which of these movies were your favorites, which of them scarred you, which of them changed you, which of them made you laugh way harder than you thought you should have. Until the next time, party on, watch out for spiders, and remember, never trust a dessert in a teen comedy.
This is Jack Burton and the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Live a war. You gotta become war.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
You trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to our countdown of the top 100 movies from the 1990s, where nostalgia meets neon and every entry is a blast from the VHS past. This lineup we're about to get into proves the 90s were firing on all cinematic cylinders, whether you're here for the sports underdog stories, the political thrillers, party-starting comedies, or terrifying urban legends. There's something here for every movie lover who lived or wished they had lived through one of the most spectacular decades in cinema. In this episode, we're diving into the movies I have ranked 81 through 90, what I think is a wildly entertaining collection of movies that are just packed with explosive action, iconic romances, hard-hitting drama, and a whole lot of style. So grab your pager, cue the mixtape, and let's hit play on more unforgettable gems from the 90s. In House Party, Reginald Hudlin would let Kid and Play throw the ultimate teenage bash, complete with dance battles, awkward teen romance, parent dodging, high school bullies, and high top fade excellence in a hip-hop comedy that's all about the fun, the music, the friends, and of course, the footwork. Now, House Party is what happens when you mix dance battles with parental disobedience in peak 90s fashion into one wild feel-good night of fun. This comedy has the simplest of blueprints. Play wants to throw the ultimate party. Kid wants to go, but he's grounded by his hilariously furious dad, played by the late, great Robin Harris. Cue the stealth mission, a fun, high-energy journey through the neighborhood and a party so iconic it features an all-time dance battle that still gets referenced to this day. Kid's towering high-top fade is a character in itself, and Play brings the smooth talk, the swagger, and more than a few just hilariously questionable pickup lines. I love Martin Lawrence in this movie. He's just full manic energy mode here as the DJ with zero filter and dragon breath for days, while full force plays the least intimidating bullies that you've ever seen in crop tops and Jordans. The humor here ranges from slapstick to snarky to surreal to clever at times, but I think underneath all the laughs, House Party captures just the essence of youthful teen freedom and community. It's not just about a party, it's about that feeling of being young and wild and just cool enough to get away with it. The soundtrack is loaded with jams, the fashion is outrageous in the best of ways, the chemistry between kid and play just gives the whole thing an effortlessly laid-back charm. House Party isn't just a time capsule, I think it's a cultural landmark, and nearly 35 years later, it still knows how to get the whole room dancing. John Woo would set the screen ablaze in Hard Boiled, an operatic Hong Kong action blitz starring Chow Yun-fat as a no-nonsense cop with a collection of pistols and more bullets than dialogue in a movie that just helped redefine the action genre mayhem. John Woo's Hard Boiled to me is just a beautiful mashup of slow-motion bullets, jazz solos, and unfiltered cool. I mean, released at the height of Hong Kong action cinema, this gem stars Chow Yun-fat as Tequila. He's a cop who plays his clarinet at night in the club and dual wields his pistols during the day. The plot here, honestly, it doesn't really matter. There's some stuff about arms dealers. There's an undercover cop played by a Tony Leung who's just in peak brooding mode here, and a criminal syndicate as well that's operating out of this hospital. But to me, the plot in Hard Boiled is really just a loose string that ties together some of the most dazzling and over-the-top action sequences ever filmed. From the tea house shootout at the opening scene, where Tequila's just blowing away dozens of goons while sliding down stair railings, to the film's near 40-minute climax in a maternity ward, Hard Boiled turns just carnage into choreography, into just effortless, elegant violence. It's a gun ballet, there's glass shattering and explosions erupting like kids on prom night. Woo's trademarks are all over this movie. There's doves flying in slow motion, impossible reloads, and characters that stare into each other's souls before unleashing mayhem. I think Chow Yun-fat is perfect here. He's smooth, he's dangerous, and somehow always in the right place with a gun in each hand and a one-liner in his back pocket. This is honestly, though, more than an action movie. I mean, to me, Hard Boiled is kind of like a symphony of destruction, and it plays loudly. I remember stumbling onto this movie one night on cable as a teenager. It blew me away then, and I always looked for it after that. It's always been a movie that stuck with me since. I don't think Hard Boiled just raised the bar for shootouts. I think it somersaulted over it, tossed it up in the air, and then shot it in the face. Nora Ephron's Sleepless in Seattle brings together Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan in a coast-to-coast romance leap of faith where one grieving dad, one curious radio DJ, and one perfectly timed Empire State Building meeting captured the hearts of audiences worldwide. Now, if Sleepless in Seattle doesn't melt the cockles of your heart, then you might be missing cockles altogether. Directed by the great Nora Ephron and starring rom-com royalty Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, this movie practically wrote the blueprint for 90s romance. Hanks here plays Sam Baldwin. He's a grieving widower whose son calls a radio show to help his dad find love again, and the result is, conveniently, women all over the country start falling for Sam's gentle and emotionally available voice. One of those listeners is Meg Ryan's Annie, who becomes so captivated she hops a plane and low-key stalks this man across the country. Yet somehow, because it's the movies, we still root for her. It's also because it's Meg Ryan. It was the 90s, and she was basically the human form of romantic hope and perfect hair. Now, to be clear, Sam and Annie only spend about 3 to maybe 4 minutes of actual screen time together. Most of their romance is built on vibes and fate and the firm belief that if something feels right, it more than likely is. It's a love story built around longing and letters and wistful voiceovers. It's basically the prequel to online dating with sweet Empire State Building meetups instead of Tinder swipes. I think Efron here, though, does balance all the sugar with the wit, and the emotional payoff is somehow enormous despite the minimal direct interaction between these characters, which really is further proof that chemistry doesn't always need dialogue. Sometimes it just needs good writing and a swelling score. This movie used destiny as a plot device and was able to revive the grown-up romance drama. It's sentimental, yes, but it never tips into syrupy. Instead, it kind of taps into the deep universal belief that love, true love, may be out there somewhere, just waiting for you to come along and pick it up and put it in your mouth. Curtis Hanson would dive into the dark and glamorous rot of 1950s Hollywood in L.A. Confidential, a tangled noir web starring Guy Pearce, Russell Crowe, Kevin Spacey, and Kim Basinger, where every cop has secrets and every smile hides a gun. I've always enjoyed this movie. It's a crime saga that peels back the polished surface of 1950s Los Angeles, and specifically Hollywood and the surrounding areas, just revealing a city full of secrets and sleaze and very bad cops doing very bad things for very good reasons. Our three morally murky protagonists in this film are all excellent. You get Guy Pearce as the rule book worshiper, then you get Russell Crowe as the brooding bruiser, and then you get Kevin Spacey as the slick celebrity cop. I think each do bring their own baggage to this case that involves murder and prostitution in this gossip rag called Hush Hush. I love Danny DeVito here. He narrates like a tabloid gremlin that you can't help but love. I really do think this movie has everything. You get shootouts in nightclubs, double crosses in diners. There's enough plot twists to make a pretzel look straight. It's a movie that's slick and smart and really just perfectly dressed. Kim Basinger in her Oscar-winning role just glides through this movie like a lost Lauren Bacall clone. She's equal parts icy and vulnerable and just fantastic in this character. And while you may need to take some notes on the plot, I think it's all wrapped in just razor sharp dialogue with smoky lighting and a score that makes you want to pour a bourbon and just stare off moodily into nothing. It's dark, it's deadly, and it's somehow cool as hell. LA Confidential didn't just flirt with greatness, it blackmailed it, it slapped it around, and then walked off with its plush fedora. Say his name five times and regret everything. Candyman, directed by Bernard Rose, starring Virginia Madsen and Tony Todd, mixes urban legend with supernatural terror in a haunting tale that slices much deeper than your average surface-level slasher. To me, this is easily one of the most haunting, poetic, and strangely seductive horror films from the 90s. Candyman wasn't just a slasher flick, it's like a gothic urban legend thriller just dipped in honey and blood with a hook-handed killer who quotes literature and floats like a ghostly philosopher of pain. Then you get Virginia Madsen, who's fantastic here as well as Helen. She's this grad student researching urban myths in Chicago's Cabrini Green housing projects. Now, naturally, she's skeptical of the local legend about this vengeful spirit named Candyman, but that's until the bodies start dropping and mirrors start becoming portals to a very bad place. I love Tony Todd in this movie. He's really perfect for the role. He delivers Candyman with just an elegant menace. He's delivering Shakespearean monologues with a voice that could just melt through steel, all while being covered in bees like he's on an episode of Fear Factor. But I think what sets Candyman apart isn't just all the scares. It's really just the atmosphere overall. Philip Glass's eerie score just haunts every frame. The cinematography is dreamlike and hypnotic, and the themes, they hit hard. You get race, gentrification, the exploitation of trauma, and how legends are born and sustained. It's horror with a brain and a beating, bleeding heart. This was always one of my favorite horror movies growing up, hands down. It's always creeped me out more than most horror movies had at the time, and even to this day. And While 90s horror at the time was veering towards meta and teen-driven romps, Candyman was one that dared to be mature and mythic and uncomfortably real. It wasn't a hit on the level of a Freddy or a Jason movie, but I think Candyman did build a legacy all its own, and in my opinion, it's a movie that certainly does earn a permanent place in the Horror Hall of Fame. Robert Rodriguez brings the bullets, the blood, and the guitars to Desperado, a revenge rampage soaked in style with Antonio Banderas, Salma Hayek, and Danny Trejo, where a mysterious mariachi turns a sleepy town into a blood-soaked south-of-the-border action symphony. To me, Desperado is the cinematic equivalent of a flaming tequila shot. It's loud, it's stylish, it's guaranteed to leave you slightly dizzy, and you'll definitely be ready for round two. Directed by a then-rising Robert Rodriguez, this, of course, is the sequel to his $7,000 indie hit El Mariachi, but with a bigger budget, more characters, louder guns, and Banderas in full guitar-slinging revenge mode. Think Spaghetti Western by way of MTV. The plot is a revenge tale as old as Bullets. A mysterious mariachi plays by Banderas rolls into a Mexican town looking to settle a score with a drug lord, and along the way, he shreds on his guitar and shoots literally everybody that comes across his path. Salma Hayek shows up as the bookshop owner, who luckily for us gets mixed up in things as well, and I think this movie just has an atmosphere all its own. Rodriguez directs this with just finesse. He salsas with the camera. Gunfights explode into choreographed chaos. Slow motion standoffs are just soaked and cool, and every bar shootout feels like a flamenco of destruction. Steve Buscemi shows up to narrate. Cheech Marin pours some tequila, and Danny Trejo is just throwing knives like an angry chef on a Friday night. Desperado would really mark Rodriguez's arrival as the new prince of pulp in the genre, blending Tarantino-level violence with Latin flair and a DIY filmmaking ethos. It was slick and sexy and stylish at a time when action films were either going full grit or full goofy. More than just a shoot-em-up, though, I think Desperado is just a love letter to mythic heroes and mariachi music and the idea that your guitar case could also hold an RPG. It's kind of cool without trying. It was dangerous with a wink and an action gem that still rocks the screen all these years later. Rudy, starring Sean Astin, is the ultimate underdog story where one scrappy kid with no talent, no size, and no quit dares to suit up for Notre Dame and tackles our tear ducts in the process in one of the most memorable sports flicks of all time. Now, if you've ever been told that you're too small, too slow, or just not good enough, then Rudy is your cinematic rally cry. This underdog sports saga follows Daniel Rudy Rudiger, a real-life 5-foot-nothing dreamer who dared to take on this Fighting Irish football team armed with nothing but heart, grit, his jockstrap, and a stubborn refusal to quit. I think Sean Astin was fantastic in this movie. He kills this performance as Rudy with just a wide-eyed natural optimism and an unwavering determination that could melt a glacier. He's not a natural athlete. He doesn't have the grades, and his family treats Notre Dame like a church they'll never be allowed into. But Rudy grinds anyways, on the field, in the classroom, and through life's endless fumbles. And yes, will cry, don't fight it, the moment the team lays their jerseys on the desk. Brutal when Rudy finally takes the field. Emotional destruction when the crowd starts chanting Rudy, Rudy, and Jerry Goldsmith's inspirational score swells. Game over, dude, get the Kleenex. I mean, even the coldest of sports fans will be wiping away tears with their foam fingers, because Rudy isn't just football. It's about perseverance, identity, and proving that dreams matter even when they're unlikely. It's a love letter to just long shots and late bloomers, and it doesn't pretend that there are shortcuts along the way. This film became a staple in locker rooms and classrooms across America. Personally, I've always been a scrappy believer, and I've always watched this movie growing up before every season of tryouts as a kid, whether it was basketball, football, or baseball. This isn't a flashy film, but that's the point. Neither was Rudy. In Three Kings, David O. Russell turns the Gulf War into a gritty gold heist with George Clooney, Mark Wahlberg, and Ice Cube, where the bullets are real, the humor is dark, and everybody's just trying to survive long enough to split the loot. Three Kings is what happens when a heist movie, a war film, and a politically charged satire all collide in the middle of the desert, and somehow it works like a charm. Directed by David O. Russell before he went full awards bait, this 1999 gem is set during the tail end of the Gulf War and stars George Clooney, Mark Wahlberg, and Ice Cube. They're U.S. soldiers who find a treasure map in the back pocket of a surrendering Iraqi. No, really. This is the Desert Storm version of One-Eyed Willie's Rich Stuff, and Wahlberg, Cube, and Clooney are the commando versions of the Goonies. Their goal to steal Saddam Hussein's hidden stash of gold. Their journey is a descent into the real human cost of war, and it's all wrapped in adrenaline, absurdity, and camera filters that look like they were dipped in motor oil. Clooney plays the world-weary major with a stylish grit. Wahlberg is the young soldier who learns lessons the hard way, and Ice Cube, carrying the quiet cool of someone who doesn't need to raise his voice, just wants to survive so he can say it was a good day, yet it's Spike Jonze playing a lovable redneck with a malfunctioning moral compass that nearly steals the movie here. What starts as a post-war treasure hunt becomes a biting critique of American intervention, media manipulation, and military bureaucracy, and yet it never forgets to entertain. One minute you're watching a slick shootout, the next minute you're reeling from a gut punch of human drama. Tonally, it's a tightrope walk, and somehow Russell sticks the landing. It's sharp, smart, stylishly subversive. Not many movies make you laugh, think, and sweat in the same scene, but Three Kings is certainly one that does. Oliver Stone cranks the volume to a 12 in Any Given Sunday, a sweaty, snarling football epic starring Al Pacino, Jamie Foxx, Cameron Diaz, and LL Cool J, where every play is war, every locker room is chaos, and every monologue sounds like it came from a recruitment video. Now, Any Given Sunday is Oliver Stone's chaotic and emotionally jacked up Super Bowl of a movie. It's a gridiron epic that tackles football not as a game, but more so as a full contact war for legacy and money and ego and TV ratings. Directed with Stone's signature whiplash editing, turbocharged symbolism, this movie feels less like watching a football game and more like being hit by a linebacker when you're not looking. Yet, for some reason, it's always been one of my favorite football movies. You get Al Pacino as the old school coach of the fictional Miami Sharks. He's a man that's fighting for relevance in a sport that's quickly outpacing his principles. He's clashing with the ambitious new team owner played by Cameron Diaz. He's babysitting an egomaniac quarterback in Dennis Quaid and trying to wrangle in a wild card backup QB played with a breakout bravado by Jamie Foxx. Behold the origin of Steamin' Willie Beeman, a name you will never forget once it's sung to you in a locker room rap. I mean, this movie is just jammed with everything. It's got hard hits, it's got locker room meltdowns, eye-popping tackles, and more slow-mo than a shampoo commercial. Stone really uses every camera angle known to mankind, often in the same scene. It's gritty, it's loud, it's abrasive, and it's constantly at 150%. There's even a Lawrence Taylor cameo where he plays a dangerously concussed linebacker because subtlety was clearly benched for this movie. And of course, there's the speech. I mean, Pacino's inch by inch locker room monologue is the Rocky Balboa of pet talks. It's overwrought, inspirational, and unforgettable. And Any Given Sunday may not be a traditional football movie or a traditional sports movie, but it's a wild blend of sports and vanity and grit, and it's just a time capsule of Y2K era masculinity, corporate pressure, and on-field carnage. It's messy, it's ambitious, it's totally over the top, kind of like football itself. John Singleton throws college life into a pressure cooker with Higher Learning, a sharp and tense drama starring Omar Epps, Christy Swanson, Ice Cube, and Michael Rapaport, where race, identity, and ideology clash on a volatile campus that's anything but safe. Now, Higher Learning isn't your typical college movie. It's an intense, ambitious drama that drops you into fictional Columbia University and dares you to confront the tough stuff. Race, gender, identity, power, and violence, all swirling just beneath the surface of frat parties and freshman awkwardness. The cast here is just stacked with rising stars from the 90s. Omar Epps plays a talented but frustrated athlete. Christy Swanson plays a sheltered student discovering feminism. And Michael Rapaport plays a lonely, radicalized outsider whose arc takes a deeply unsettling turn. Then you get Lawrence Fishburne channeling equal parts Yoda and James Baldwin as a professor who drops knowledge in a Trinidadian accent that could stop traffic. Singleton isn't subtle here, but that's the point. I mean, this film is bold, it's raw, it's unflinching in its examination of systemic issues bubbling up in America, and especially on college campuses. Racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, white supremacy, it's all here. It hits hard. Some of it feels uncomfortably ahead of its time. Some of it does still sting because much haven't changed. And really, sure, some of it is messy in place. Tone admittedly does wobble a little bit. The symbolism, it can be heavy-handed, and the third act does go full Greek tragedy, but there's also power in that chaos. Singleton aimed high here, and even when the film fumbles, it stumbles with the purpose. Higher Learning may not be your typical 90s coming-of-age tale, but it's a movie that hit hard in the 90s and still lands plenty of punches today. If you want lighthearted school spirit, maybe try Legally Blonde, but if you want to leave campus with something to think about, I think Higher Learning is still a movie that's very much a class in session. And there you have it, guys. That's it for today. 10 more essential 90s movies that I think defined the decade in totally different but equally awesome ways, whether it's the raw power of Any Given Sunday, the slick noir brilliance of LA Confidential, or the unforgettable music from House Party. Every film in this batch brought something fresh, fierce, and just flat out fun to the screen during the 90s. But we're only getting warmer as we inch closer to that top spot. And if you like these picks, if they made you laugh, they made you cry, or made you want to slow motion dive with a couple of pistols, just wait until the next batch of movies. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and hit that bell so you don't miss out on the next video covering movies number 71 through 80. It's right around the corner. The 90s train will keep rolling, and it's packed with even more cult classics, heavy hitters, and surprise favorites that you're not going to want to miss.
This is Jack Burton and the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Survive a war. You gotta become war.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
You trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?